From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. It is Valentine's Day. Whether celebrated joyfully or begrudgingly, it's the holiday when the varieties of love and the absence of love come sharply into focus. We are marking this day with Tayari Jones. Oprah chose her novel An American Marriage for her book club a year ago. It's now coming out in paperback. It was named among the best books of the year by a number of critics and by former President Barack Obama. The story of an Atlanta couple bound together and torn apart by a skewed criminal justice system reminds us that no love exists in a vacuum. Tayari Jones is author of four novels now. She recently returned to her native city to teach writing at Emory. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, so glad to have you with us. I hear that the origins of the story came from an Atlanta mall.
It's true. At the time I was working on a novel, I knew I wanted to write a novel about wrongful imprisonment. But, you know, wrongful imprisonment isn't a story. It's a problem. It's a situation, but it's not a story. You know, they say as a novelist, you're supposed to write about people and their problems, not problems and their people. And I didn't know what I was going to do, but I went to Lenox Mall. And while I was there, I overheard a couple arguing. I could tell they were in love and in trouble. And I heard the woman say, "Roy, you know you wouldn't have waited on me for 7 years." And I was intrigued. Also because he looked back at her and said, "I don't know what you're talking about. This wouldn't have happened to you in the first place." For me, I have a novel when I have a situation where the characters disagree, they're in conflict, but no one's really wrong.
And you went to town with that.
To town.
Well, and much of it is An American Marriage is set in Atlanta. And like the character Celestial, you're from here. Where did you grow up in Atlanta?
I grew up on the southwest side of Atlanta. I went to Benjamin Mays High School. I graduated from Spelman College. Like, I am completely an Atlanta person.
And your parents were both academics, right?
Yes, my mother taught at Clark College when I was growing up, and my father taught political science at Atlanta University.
So an economist and a political scientist. Were you aware as a child that you were growing up in this academic surroundings, or was it just, you know, like nature?
No, I mean, I'd never thought about education as something that was extra. It was just in the water, really. I mean, one of the things I think about is when I was a little kid, I actually thought graduate student was a kind of cousin. I thought everyone had graduate students. I would say to my little friends, "Oh, is that your graduate student?" And they would look at me like, "What, huh?"
Well, you went on to study at Spelman, as you said. What was it like going from growing up in Atlanta around parents who had lots of graduate students around and to being part of it as a student?
You know, my parents moved to Houston right before I went to college. And so I was the youngest student in my class. I was 16. So I think it was a perfect balance for me to, as my mother said, you don't have to leave home if home leaves you. So while other kids went away to college, my parents went, I feel like my parents went away so that I could go to college. I look at my years at Spelman as the happiest time. Just such a time of growth and excitement. Janetta Cole was our first Black woman president at Spelman. And one day she said to me, you know, she has a big booming voice. She said, "How's the writing?" And that was the first time anyone had ever spoken to me like I was a writer. And I mean, this is going to sound so, I don't know, but I was so young and I wanted to make her proud.
Oh. And Janetta Cole, doesn't she appear in the book somewhere? She's a character.
Yes,
briefly.
I have to, you know, tip my hat where it is due.
But you were only 16 years old. So were you a prodigy? Were you just, you know, this promising, brilliant student?
No, I don't think so. There are a lot of us.
You don't think so, but maybe the people who are running the school did.
There are a lot of 16-year-old freshmen out there. I feel like we're all part of a secret club. I meet them. I met one just yesterday at DeKalb County Public Library. I do think that precocity makes for a very unique mindset. I don't know. I'm real ambivalent about it. I don't regret going to school so early, but I often wonder what my life would have been like. But I can't complain. As I think Roy says in the book, when you get where you're going, sometimes you don't care how you got there.
Yeah, well, he also caught the first thing smoking out of his little Louisiana town, as you put it in the book, which I thought was something that I could definitely relate to. And Roy went on to live in Atlanta, where you studied at Spelman with the playwright and author Pearl Clegg. She was one of your professors, right? How do you remember meeting her?
Well, I wanted to take the creative writing class, but it wasn't open to freshmen. And this is before computers when you could get away with things. I kind of maybe perhaps forged the advisor's signature so that I could be allowed in the class because I wanted to study with her. I just admired the way she spoke. She seemed so smart and so like beautifully eccentric. She seemed to be modeling a life of art and ideas and defiance. So I took the class and I sat there on the front row and she really took me under her wing. And she didn't kick me out of the class when it was discovered that I was ineligible.
I'm glad the statute of limitations is probably out on that one. But here's Pearl Clegg later talking with an audience at Emory University about the class that you were in at Spelman.
Most of the young women in there, they may have read something that I had written, or they kind of had a vague idea that they were interested in writing. But then I had one student who was so determined to be a writer. She was so serious about it, so that when we would have this huge class, and there were a lot of people in the class who were so not serious, and they would try to divert attention, as students will do when they haven't done the writing they were supposed to do. So they want you to talk all over here and all that. And that used to drive Tiari crazy. So she came up to me after class one day and said, "These girls are not serious. You should make them be quiet. I'm trying to learn from you, and they won't be quiet. I said, "Okay, here's what we're going to do."
We can hear you laughing on stage with her there. So what did you two do to get around all these distractions in class?
Well, you know, I would meet her in office hours. But the most exciting thing about that time in my life is that Pearl used to run a salon called Live at Club Zebra. And she invited me to go. And there were all these people. They were like reciting poetry, playing saxophones. They were, complaining about the government. It was just so exciting. And I thought, is this what life will be like if I'm an artist? Is this the kind of adult life that awaits me? I felt like, sign me up.
So I'm trying to imagine you, 16 years old, precocious, go to your writing teacher and say, "These people aren't serious enough for me." Who were you?
Well, you know, you think about it, I grew up around professors all the time, so I didn't have that distance between myself and a professor in that way. Also, Pearl was the only professor we had at Spelman who wanted us to call her by her first name. So I just felt like she and I were kindred spirits. I had no idea that we would still be so close all these years later. But when I met her, I knew I had found my person.
And she, it sounds like, not only modeled writing for you, but what being a writer was? Or did she?
Yes. I mean, one thing I really am grateful about, because I teach undergraduates now, and I find now that young people know so much about the business side of things. They know about agents and editors and film rights. Pearl never spoke to me about any of that commerce stuff. It was all about, what do you understand the truth to be? How can you use your fictional stories to get at something that is fundamentally true? And I'm so grateful that she didn't train me up on the road to try to win prizes or see and be seen. She kind of presented an artistic life to me as a pure endeavor and an endeavor about constant growth.
So you were very determined to become a writer, and she clearly saw that. Was there any particular pieces of advice that you took away from her that you can share?
Through the years, there's been so much, but the time I really think that Pearl kind of came to my rescue is after I finished college. I was doing a PhD in literature that I didn't want, right? I felt like in studying literature, I felt like I was a bird and I was being trained to be an ornithologist. I wanted to fly, but I didn't know how to leave the PhD program. I felt that I would disappoint my parents because they have PhDs. I felt like I would disappoint my professors who really wanted me to get a PhD. And she told me, she wrote me a postcard and she said, "Remember, your life is just that, your life. You can make choices to be the person you know you can be." And that permission, I really altered the course of my life. She was the only person who felt that I should put my art first and central. Everyone else kind of was like, "Oh, you can write on the weekends, you can do it later." She was the one who believed that I could do it. And I think it's because she was doing it. She knew, not only did she know that I could do it, but kind of more in general, she understood that it could be done.
That is a beautiful form of love, that love of a teacher to a student. And now you are teaching, you're a professor of writing at Emory. What does it mean for you to be a mentor to those young people?
You know, I really adore teaching undergraduates because in my previous position at Rutgers, I was teaching graduate students. And graduate students have 2 years before you launch them into the profession. So there isn't a lot of time to experiment and play, I guess I'll say. But with undergraduates, you know, they're finding their voice, they're finding their subject matter. It is a lighter endeavor, and it just has so much potential for growth and reward. I just adore them.
I'm speaking with Tayari Jones. She's a professor of writing at Emory and, of course, a best-selling novelist, most recently of An American Marriage, which is about to come out in paperback. Well, after graduating from Spelman, you went on to earn degrees from University of Iowa, Arizona State University. You've written 4 novels since, all of them set in Georgia, and most of them are about relatively young people. Are they in some way autobiographical?
I do think that every novel is emotionally autobiographical. But when I came to write, well, my first novel is called Leaving Atlanta, and it is about growing up in Atlanta during the Atlanta child murders.
Yeah, these are like fifth graders, right?
Yes, because I was in the fifth grade at the time, and I noticed that no one ever talked about what it was like to be a child during the murders, because people think that the child murders were kind of something that happened to parents. Like when I would tell people I grew up at that time, they would say, oh my goodness, your poor mother. And I wanted to write about the way it shaped the coming of age of a generation. So that kind of felt natural to use young characters. But when it came time to write An American Marriage, I really wanted to reach outside of my own experience and try to comment in some way about things that I see in the world that need my attention.
Aaron Jackson Jr. was among the youngest, only 9 years old. Luby Jeter was 14, Timothy Hill, 13. Patrick Baltazar, 11. For almost 2 years, the bodies have kept coming out of Atlanta's rivers and woods, and week after week, police speak of sorrow and sympathy, but not a solution.
What was it like there? Were you afraid to go outside?
This went on for 2 years, so it kind of got normalized in our lives, which I felt like we were always living in a kind of a low-level state of fear, but not a state of panic. But two of the children were students at my elementary school, and I was looking back at their pictures, and I realized how young they were, because children do not see one another as young. Children do not find one another to be cute. So children to each other are life-sized. So when I look back at the pictures and I saw one kid that I knew, Terry Pugh, he was like a couple years older than us. I think he had repeated a grade or something. And he always seemed so old, so much older than we were. And when I saw his picture and saw that he was just a little boy, probably like 12 or 13 years old, it helped me understand what perspective means. But one thing I thought about when I was writing the book, I was really curious as to what kind of indelible lesson each of us took from that experience. Like for me, I realized it made me understand class was a significant factor in life. Everyone remembers the child murders as, you know, 28 black children were killed, and this is true, but they were mostly from Atlanta's poor and working class neighborhoods. And that was a very significant factor in the conversation about what was going on. I mean, many of the kids were doing things to raise money to help their mom pay the rent. So I have a character in my novel who was selling blow pops at the West End Mall when he was last seen. The children were vulnerable because they had to take on kind of adult responsibilities. And that's something that I learned that I never forgot, that other kids right there in my same fifth grade classroom, we weren't living the same life.
And class certainly comes up in An American Marriage too. But I'm thinking of another one of your novels, Silver Sparrow, and this is opens, "My father, James Witherspoon, is a bigamist." And we meet these two teenage half-sisters, Dana and Charisse. And like An American Marriage, the story is told from more than one perspective. And it's told in Atlanta. What is it about those different voices and coming back to Atlanta in your novels for you?
You know, I keep saying next novel, I'm not going to do the different voices, because I do think there's you kind of want to have variety and show your range. But some stories only work in various first-person voices. Like, so in Silver Sparrow, we have our two girls. They have the same dad. One is a secret daughter, and one is the public daughter. And just to hear their different takes on life with the same father, just their voices just made it more resonant to me to hear it from, you know, their own points of view and their own idiom. And Atlanta, I mean, obviously it's my natural habitat, but also I am intrigued by the urban South. I consider myself representing Southern writers. When I lived in New York for 10 years, you know, when you live in New York and you tell people you're from Georgia, they act like you got up here on the Underground Railroad or something. And I do think it's very important that we writers from the South and also from other parts of the country, that we represent our hometowns, because that is what American literature is. It's a very diverse and regional literature. And so I just feel like I am just representing, bearing witness, and taking notes.
Could these stories happen anywhere but Atlanta for you?
No. No, I mean, Atlanta is a very unique city. There is no such thing as, quote unquote, any town USA. I hate it when people say that, because that's implying that there is a standard of Americanness and the rest of us are just kind of offshoots.
Well, with that, we have to cue Outkast, who could not have come from any town but Atlanta. My guest on this Valentine's Day is novelist and educator Tayari Jones. We're talking about her life and her work and the things that she loves. And we will continue our conversation after a short break. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is On Second Thought.
Say happy Valentine's Day. Every day the 14th. Can y'all dig that? Now, when arrows don't penetrate, see. Now look at here, he shoots straight for your heart. Now, and he won't miss you. But that's alright, y'all won't believe in me anyway, but
you won't believe in me, but you
From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. And we're continuing our conversation with Atlanta author Tayari Jones on this Valentine's Day. We're talking about, among other things, her best-selling novel, An American Marriage. It's a love story and a tragedy about power, family, self-determination, and how all those things influence the kind of choices made in love. Well, let's get back to that idea of any town USA. You named your book An American Marriage, not A Southern Marriage or Scenes from a Marriage or The Story of Roy and Celestial and Andre. Tell me about when that decision to name it came to you.
Well, you know, it was after the book was done. I turned it into my editor and he wanted us to come up with another title. And I was just in jest saying, oh, we could call it An American Marriage. And I was laughing saying that, you know, when people want to sound important, they put the word American in the title. And I even told him that my cat, Canella, was writing a memoir. It's called American Feline. And he laughed and he was like, but no, you should call your book An American Marriage. And I really resisted because I had never been called American before in my life without another word in front of it. I've been called a Black American, African American. I've never been called American. So it felt like my book was, when they called it An American Marriage, like they wanted to make it not about me, or like I could not understand my experience as being just American. And I talked to Pearl about it because she's my go-to person when I have problems like this. And she said, you know, why don't you like the title? And I said, I felt like it sounded like a book about some white people in Connecticut, you know, getting a divorce or something. And she said, why do you think that white people in Connecticut are more American than you and me, Black people living here in Atlanta? And, you know, I was just kind of stammering about it. And she said, this, you are American. The story is American. This love story intersecting with prison in this way, that is something that is a distinctly American issue. But even if he had not gone to prison, this love story is American because Atlanta is a uniquely American city. And just hearing her keep using that word American, American, and talking about me and my work, it did cause a shift in my thinking. And I decided that even though at first I thought calling it American felt, I don't know, like a dodge or a feint, that it was actually very subversive and a declaration to call this An American Marriage. And so, you know, I told the editor, I was like, let's do it. And he said, oh, thank goodness, because we've already made the cover.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the origin of coming to this book, because you write in the paperback edition, there is an essay that you wrote about coming to write this book and why you wrote this book. Would you mind reading just a little bit of that?
Yes, the essay is called This is a Love Story. I wrote this novel 3 times. The first time, I wrote it all from the point of view of Celestial. The wrongful incarceration of her husband is the creeping fear made real. She struggles under the pressure to stand by her man, which is exacerbated by the fact that he is innocent. She's talented and independent and not cut out to be dutiful. These are the attributes that intrigue Roy and me. For some reason, this approach just didn't work. After a frustrating year, I rewrote it from the point of view of Roy, the ambitious young man robbed of his liberty. This approach worked a little better. After all, a man's heroic journey is the bedrock of Western literature. Roy was like Odysseus, coming home from battle hoping to find a faithful wife and a gracious house. But this story seemed a bit too easy, familiar in a way that didn't address the questions in my mind. Finally, I realized that this story is neither his nor hers. It is theirs. Roy says to Celestial, "This wouldn't have happened to you in the first place." But it did happen to her, in that it changed her life. He loves her because she is headstrong and resourceful, but can he ever forgive her for surviving? Can she be excused for finding happiness despite this tragedy? In the letters, Roy says, "I'm innocent." Celestial replies, "I'm innocent too." Who is to blame then when everyone is innocent? And what is the value of blame at all?
That's Tayari Jones reading from an essay in the new paperback edition of her book, An American Marriage. Oh, so many things to unpack there. One, it does harken back to the couple at the mall, doesn't it? Him saying, you know, this wouldn't have happened to you. So you adopt these different voices for the book. How did you get to those voices? They're very distinct. There are two men, Andre and Roy. There are other people in the book as well, other voices. And then Celestials. How did you work to get those voices?
Finding voice is kind of magical. It's kind of like falling in love. You don't know exactly how you got there, but you know you're there. But I do think that the key for me is to be able to respect everyone's point of view. If I'm writing a character and I do not think that character has a legitimate point, I can't find voice. So I felt like Roy has a legitimate point. He has suffered, you know, all his life. He's been taught that good women wait. Like, that is real bedrock of the culture. And the way that we understand women's contribution is through loyalty, fidelity, and frankly, chastity. That is what he thinks she has to offer him. And she, on the other hand, believes that she has a right to her life. I mean, if her husband wasn't incarcerated, you would not be mad at her for wanting to be an artist. But because he's incarcerated, it seems like there's a societal expectation that all bets are off for her, like independence and self-actualization is a luxury that she, as a Black woman, cannot afford. So I just kind of leaned into both their ways of thinking, and I never forgot that they love each other and that love is not the only thing, but love matters. And I just tried to figure out, how do you balance your desires and your responsibilities? The third voice is Andre, her childhood friend. They've known each other since they were 2 babies bathing in the sink. And he's loved her all his life. And I mean, in our culture, isn't that why they put boys next door? So you can grow up and fall in love with them? So these 3 people are wrestling, trying to find kind of harmony and happiness, responsibility, but joy. They want joy.
Yeah. And those kind of relationships were imprinted on them by their parents. Very different kind of parenting styles between Big Roy and Olive, Roy's parents in a small town in Louisiana, and Celestial here in Atlanta. And that, you know, so often these stories of wrongful conviction and incarceration in the news and narrative nonfiction and even fiction, they're usually about low-income people without access to quality legal representation, they're prey to the system. Your characters are these middle-class professionals, Celestial, an artist, as you mentioned. Were you countering that prevailing image?
You know, when I write, I try not to think about other stories at all, because if you start countering an existing story, then the existing stories start to control your work. I am intrigued by Atlanta's Black middle class, and I'm also intrigued by the class stratification within the African-American community. You know, there are these studies that say that most people don't know anyone from another class than themselves, don't know anyone intimately from another class. But I don't think that this is true for Black people because of the incredible upward mobility of the 70s. Like, if you look at my own family, you know, my father grew up 10 kids in four rooms, and he grew up to be a professor because of all the advantages of the civil rights movement. So he had a rapid class jump, which is not uncommon for African Americans. So when they say most people don't know people from another class, I was like, Black people, we call people from another class, we call them our cousins. So that class interaction is more stark. And in Atlanta, we have all these people who have come to the city from smaller towns in other states, and many of them are first generation college students, and they interact with people who are from Atlanta's very established, you know, middle and upper middle class families. And there are, you know, complex relationships between them. And I don't think it's been really explored in literature. So it's something that I really always lean on in my work.
And despite all of those jumping classes, as you were talking about, it doesn't matter on some level in the eyes of the law or in the eyes of the criminal justice system. In this book, Andre says, you know, he drives a beautiful Mercedes and he's still on the back roads of Louisiana thinking, you know, the make, model, Black man, oh, that equals drug dealer to them. There's an incredible vulnerability inside of this.
Yes, there is. And class, does class matter in the eyes of the law? I'm going to say class matters kind of in the eyes of the law. I mean, people who are poor and working class have way more of these negative encounters with police. I mean, that's just a fact. But class is not a guarantee. So therefore, it is fraught across the board. And that's part of the tension in the story, this idea of privilege and access among Black people. But class didn't save Roy.
Also in the essay in the book, you write about coming to study criminal justice. You were at a fellowship, I think, at Harvard. Did you think about turning this into a novel at that time?
I did. I wanted to, but I just couldn't find the story, the spark, the characters, the moral ambiguity. When I was studying wrongful incarceration, there's no moral ambiguity. I mean, they call it wrongful incarceration because it's wrong. So when you're writing about something and it's wrong, I can't get the novel going. I feel like I'm trying to strike a match on a matchbook that's worn out and I'm not getting that crisp thing, the tension I need to make a fire. But once I started looking at the way this wrongful incarceration affected families and relationships, then I had the gray area that I needed. I feel like good fiction lives in the gray area.
I'm speaking with Tayari Jones. She is the author of An American Marriage and three other novels. She's now teaching as a professor of writing at Emory University. And we're talking about her book and let's say the various different forms of love that are in there. You just read from this essay that, you know, there is no blame. There's no blame among these people, but there is a lot of blame in this system. When you were studying wrongful incarceration, how did you decide what to leave in and what to leave out?
You know, I found the most helpful thing in my research was reading oral histories by people who were wrongfully incarcerated, because I was really trying to look at the texture of their lives, the details. I call it like the minutia of deprivation, because I wanted the reader to emotionally know what it was like, but I did not want to drag the reader, or even honestly myself, through the daily brutalities. But also, I was struck by the fact that the men I read about, they did not spend as much time thinking about the wrongfulness of their particular incarceration. They were really concerned with the system of incarceration more generally. There was no sense of, I'm special, therefore this should not be happening to me. And I was impressed by that generosity of impulse. And also, it opened me up when I was writing it that I did not have to completely just be obsessed with this one specific miscarriage of justice. I was able to look at a larger canvas of an entire world of people who live behind bars. You know, every time a person is incarcerated, that is a family separation. And that's so in many ways, this novel is about family separation.
Yeah, there's so much collateral damage from Roy's incarceration, and including for Celestial, the way that she thinks about herself, how she feels when she's waiting in line to see her husband in prison. What does she say? Something like, when I'm dressed up, it's even worse.
Yes, it is true. Like, I visit prisons often as a visiting artist, and I'm respected, and they let me in. They don't really put me through much. You know, they kind of cursory look at my purse. But if you go to prison to visit someone, to visit a man as a friend or something else, as a friend, a lover, a wife, whatever, there's a sense like you are a criminal by association. Like, you are the kind of person that associates with such people. The searches, I've seen the searches are very invasive, and the contempt, it really discourages people from visiting. People don't really like to bring the children because of the contempt and all of that. And that is one of the things that happens to Celestial, that when she goes to visit him, you know, it's so demeaning. Like, if you're dressed up, it's like, what's someone like you doing visiting someone like that? They treat you like you're an idiot. And if you're not dressed up, then they treat you. It just, there's no way to win with this. I do feel that the prison system is set up to be so demeaning to everyone, even letters. I have a number of pen pals who are incarcerated, and they take away, like, I sent a, what was it, my Thanksgiving cards? And they sent them all back because I had put a sticker on the back with a little turkey, like, just to make it festive. And they sent them back, and it was stamped, no stickers, you know, just to be mean.
There are entire chapters in the book where Roy and Celestial are communicating via letters following his incarceration. You know, this is a form of communication that's nearly extinct now. How did you decide on that as a way to move the story forward?
Well, one, people in prison write a lot of letters, and they depend on letters. As a matter of fact, if I can just say, on writeaprisoner.com, if you're interested in writing letters to prisoners, they have their addresses, and you might find a pen pal. But it is a way, letters function three ways for people in prison. One, obviously the information contained therein. Secondly, the gesture and the trouble one goes to is a gift. The gift of time to have written the letter. And three, the letter as a physical artifact that can be held, opened, reread. You know, it just means so much more than it does to, like, you and me. Mm. In the novel, the letters allow us to observe the passage of time. Roy censors what he tells Celestial. Therefore, he's protecting her and he's protecting us as a reader. We still get their voices. And like I said, I'm a letter writer in real life. I write about six letters a week. I have letters in my purse right now that I have to remember to mail on my way out. I'm trying to bring it back.
Well, good luck with that. But I'm thinking that, you know, if I were writing to you right now, I'd be a lot more rehearsed. I'd be thinking, I'm writing to Tiare Jones. I better write well. You know, there, it brings a different part of yourself to that communication.
Well, not if you write letters a lot. That's because you don't write them enough. Once you get used to it, it flows. And just think of how much you enjoy receiving mail. Don't you love it when you open the mailbox and there's like a blue envelope in there? It's so
with
exciting.
With handwritten something.
Yes. I say, if I can just give a little advice to the would-be letter writers, buy a set of very small cards so you can not be intimidated by how much space there is, and just send a note.
Do you tell that to your students?
I do. Nobody listens to me.
I mean, look dumbfounded?
This one woman approach to bringing letter writing back, it is discouraging, but I'm hanging in there.
My guest, Tiare Jones, setting us up for another song, Stevie Wonder's Signed, Sealed, Delivered on this Valentine's Day. She is a native of Atlanta. She's back in Atlanta teaching at Emory University, and she's author of, among other books, An American Marriage. We will continue our conversation after a short break. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott, and we're speaking with Atlanta native and author Tayari Jones. She's in Atlanta now teaching at Emory, back after the prodigal daughter's kind of journey. We're discussing her novel, An American Marriage, which, of course, was an Oprah book pick. How did you find out?
I was driving my car, minding my own business, and I got a block call.
Blocked. We were all wondering. We thought it might come up saying Oprah.
I think that some of the many pleasures of being Oprah is that she can call you up and change your life. So I answered the block call, and I answer block calls. My students always say, "Why did you answer?" I answer them because they're blocked. Every block call is a story. And so I say, "Hello." And she says, "Hi, this is Oprah." Her voice is so distinct. I knew it was Oprah. And, you know, Oprah's from Mississippi. I'm from Atlanta. So I said, "Ma'am." And she said she wanted to use the book for her book club.
Oh, my goodness. What did you think?
I pulled over and, oh, my goodness, I was in Las Vegas because I had a fellowship. And like panhandlers were like tapping on my window asking for money. I was shooing them away. Oprah's talking. And I'm thinking, is this my life? Is this really happening to me? And I had 5 months to keep it secret.
How did you do that?
I didn't tell a soul. I felt like I was this incredible thing that had been given to me for safekeeping, this secret. But I think the 5 months really helped me because I thought like, wow, Oprah Winfrey is literally putting her name on my book. She's lending her good name. And then I thought about all the other people in my life who've lent their good name. I mean, our names are not as big as Oprah's, but our names mean as much to us as her name means to her. And I thought about my teacher from high school who wrote a letter for me to go to college. She lent her good name. I thought about my friend who wrote a letter to my landlady in New York. She lent her good name. And I just thought of all the things we do for one another. And I was very emotional about it.
I don't blame you a bit. Here she is announcing her choice of An American Marriage as her first book club pick of 2018 and why she picked it.
You're going to want to have somebody else reading it because it's so juicy. Every chapter you're wondering, will they or won't they? And how's this going to end? You want to talk about it with somebody. I'm telling you, it's one of those books I could not put down. And as soon as I did, I called up the author and said, "I got to talk to you about this story."
So she also announced she's producing a film based on the novel. Are you involved in that?
I've met with the screenwriter. I'm excited about it. I don't know much about films. People always say, "Well, who would you cast?" And I don't know that. I'm kind of staying in my lane on this. I think it's important for the filmmakers to be able to experience this as their work of art.
Well, how do you let go of something like that? I mean, you spend months working on something. Obviously, you publish it and it's out in the world and people pick it up as they want to.
I spent 6 years working on this, actually.
Okay, so sorry. I stand corrected. Many years.
I think it's just a different project. The film is different. When I was speaking to the screenwriter, this is what she said to me that made me really understand that her work is different than mine. You know, the novel ends with an epiphany, and an epiphany looks like this. Like, we're on radio, so you can't see it, but the epiphany ends with someone kind of thinking something over, like, oh, wow, okay. That works in a novel because I'm in the person's head explaining to you how the person feels, but that is not visual. You know, having a new perspective hit you upside the head is not visual. So the screenwriter's job is to translate what I've done as a novel into something that you can see.
So you were not at all interested in being a screenwriter on this?
I've never done a screenplay. I would not want to practice on my big moment. You just have to let it go. That's the hard thing, but you have to just respect other artists and trust other artists. So yes, we're collaborating because my book is the source material, but I have to let them do what they're going to do. And I feel confident about it though and excited.
Well, I've talked to authors who've said that it's a little, you know, it's a blessing and a curse to be picked for an Oprah book or have a super successful book because there's the pressure to perform the next and the next and the next. How do you put this all in perspective?
Oh, it's not a curse. No. There's always the pressure to do the next for everyone, right? Let's say your first book isn't a success at all. It would be so hard to drag yourself out of bed and try again. So if your book is a big success, you still have to drag yourself out of bed and try again. We all have to face the challenge of trying again. I don't know. I feel very, very fortunate with this book, not just because of its success, but I feel really blessed to have been chosen to bring this particular subject and message to a wider audience. There are people thinking about wrongful incarceration who never thought about it before. So I could never describe that as a curse.
I think many people think about the New South. You were talking about representing something that may not have been everybody's picture of what life in Georgia was like. So what does that mean for you?
I love it. I have so many people say, is this, you know, really Atlanta? Because they only know what they see on television. Every time you add another voice to the conversation, it's meaningful. It matters. It moves the needle. It helps us understand each other more. I do think this is the pleasure of being a writer, is that you can put your point of view out there. And it's up for debate. Some people like it. Some people don't. But I love being part of the conversation.
How about the kind of things that you've heard from readers? You know, I just here in our little pod, we had a lot of discussions about this, and there are a couple of people who don't really love Celestial. They think that she's selfish, and then others who think that selfish, she has to live her life. She's self-determined. And I've seen kind of similar discussions in book clubs. Do you get into that at all?
You know, I just kind of listen to people. I do ask a few questions. Like, Celestial is an unusual character. She's not that much of an unusual person, but she's an unusual character. We have different standards for characters in books than we do for real life. I feel like Celestial wants from her life the same thing that you want from your life and I want from my life. I want to be an artist. I want to explore the world. It's just that when you say this is a novel about a woman whose husband is wrongfully accused, you expect that this is a novel about one brave woman's fight to free her man. And when that expectation is upended in a certain way, it's kind of disconcerting. It's almost like you ordered the salmon and they brought you the steak. And it could be a perfectly good steak, but you thought this was going to be salmon. And it takes people a minute to adjust to that. But I think it's important, because if we're going to look at the way that women's roles are changing in society, we have to demonstrate that. But change is disconcerting.
Well, and now you have a lot of interaction with your Twitter followers, your social media followers. Looking at that as kind of a treasure trove of reflections and engagement, have you enjoyed working on this platform and this little micro communication?
Oh, you know, it's really fun. I've been on Twitter since, I think, like 2006. Like, I was an early adopter, and I like these little small snippets of conversation that I see. And I do like seeing the people, the online book clubs, you know, tweet about the book. And I did see someone say something and it was on Twitter, so it was very short, but it was helpful, about this question about Celestial and Roy. And someone said, is it more selfish to ask someone to wait for you, or is it more selfish not to wait on someone? And I thought, oh, I should have put that in my discussion questions. Thank you, you know, Twitter person that I don't know. And Twitter allows you to talk to so many people from, you know, all over the world. Sometimes I have to use the translate button because there are readers reading my books in different languages. And I want to know what they're talking about.
They're talking about you and this book, which has started conversations about love and marriage and race and criminal justice and grief and how people express themselves or don't. For Celestial, expression is making art. She makes these poupée dolls, and poupée is French for dolls. Some of them are portraits, some of them more symbolic and political. Where did you get the idea for having her make dolls?
Well, I have a very good friend who makes dolls, and her dolls are called muñecas, which is Spanish, but her family is from Honduras. And I was always just so impressed with her artistry and the amount of time she would spend on her work. And also, as a woman artist, she makes these dolls. It can take years, and people sometimes regard them as toys for girls. And I feel that way sometimes as a writer. You know, I spend 6 years on this book, and people say, oh, have you written a romance novel? And I say, well, it's about this and that. And the man might say, oh, I'll get a copy for my wife. You know, like, he imagines me on a certain gendered track. And I was also interested in what I like to call the ethics of portrait making. When Celestial makes the dolls and they look like Roy, at first he's delighted. He feels like, oh, I'm her muse. All her work is inspired by me. But then when he is incarcerated and she's making dolls in his image and she's successful, he feels like she is profiting from his story, profiting from his face, his pain. And so there's a kind of a line there, like what is tribute? What is exploitation? Can you steal someone's story? I have a friend, he says, you're always stealing my best lines for your books. And I'm like, I haven't stolen your lines. You still say that all the time. You still have it. I haven't stolen anything. But he was playing, but he wasn't playing. And I have stopped quoting him, even though he says the most colorful things.
Roy is so broken, you know, physically broken, emotionally broken by this experience. By the time he does get out, is still alive and vibrant. But you talked earlier about the idea of what's expected, you know, the sort of dutiful role of the woman who waits. And then the performed maleness of coming out and trying to reclaim one's life. What are these saying about this very American love story? Where are you going with that?
I really feel that the way that Roy ultimately is able to reclaim his life is through letting go of these expectations, these very gendered expectations. He thinks that what he has lost is his job, his woman, his status, and he wants these things back. He's full of rage. He wants to fight someone to get these things back. But what he really has lost is his understanding that he is a person that has something emotional to contribute to the people in his life. Because that's just not a story we're told, that you can find your way back as a man through your open heart, and not just in trying to, you know, plant your flag, you know, in your marriage or romantically and assert yourself as a patriarch of your home, that you actually can reclaim your citizenship in your own life through contribution. And that's what he comes to understand. That's a lesson that everyone should learn. He went to prison and all these things happened to him. His life is in danger, like all these things. It's how he came to understand that, but it's an important way to critique these kind of tropes of masculinity. Like, he gets into an incredible fight. Like, I was so afraid in reading this that someone was going to get killed. He could have gone back to jail, all of this because of this way that he's been taught to express his rage through violence. It could have cost him everything. And the thing that helps him regain his life is a quiet, simple act.
He carries this idea of bravado at the same time, or the way that men have always behaved. And it seems like in this book, I see a real distinction, not just in class in Roy's case, you know, he's moved on up to the big city, but also a difference in generation, the way that the father that he grew up with and his real father, his birth father, and his mother lived their life and performed their relationship is different than the way that he wants to do it, in the same way that the Atlanta that Celestial grew up with is different. The Atlanta that you grew up with is different. And things move on. And is that part of what you're presenting to us, a kind of new way of thinking of an American marriage?
Well, yes. I mean, change is really disconcerting. And I do think that Roy's challenge of being wrongfully incarcerated, because he was kind of trying to be a modern man. He liked that his wife was headstrong and successful. He imagined that they would be kind of in partnership together in a business, very different than the traditional kind of mother confined to the domestic sphere that he grew up with. And he wanted that. But then when this terrible thing happened in his life, I always say that when the going gets tough, you know, people get really conservative. And so his values were really challenged by this. And hers were too. Like, everyone in the book, Roy's incarceration challenged how much they were committed to kind of a progressive idea of marriage.
Before we started, you were going through your schedule with, you know, just to do your sound check, and you're super busy. You're really in a lot of different places. And there is a quote from the book about peace being something that you have to make. How are you able to find peace in the midst of all of this busyness?
I've never been this busy in my life. I'm always somewhere. I've always got a schedule somewhere to be. And I do feel on some level that I'm not exactly participating. in my life the way that I want to or the way that I should. But I keep telling myself, by the end of the year, by the end of the year. But moving home has caused me to slow down more. My parents live here in Atlanta. Like, when I leave here, I'm going to go pick up Daddy, and we're going to go to Waffle House. And I'm going to take this hour, hour and a half, and have Waffle House with my dad. Yes, I have 4 more appointments today. I have to drive to Athens, but I will spend this time with Daddy because, you know, this time is precious. And it helps me to be home, to remember that.
Tayari Jones, what a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun. I appreciate you having me on.
Tayari created a Spotify playlist of songs for her novel, An American Marriage. We're listening to Prince's song, Adore, one of those tracks, right now. She's going to be doing a reading at Emory University's Cox Hall Ballroom next Tuesday. That's February 19th. For details, visit gpbnews.org. And our show is produced by the Tayari Jones Fangirl Posse, Elena Rivera, Leighton Rowell, LaRaven Taylor, and Amelia Brock. Alex Word is our engineer, Don Smith, our dean of grammar, and Amy Kiley, senior producer. If you missed any of today's show or want to listen on your own time or share it with a friend, you can hit the Programs tab for On Second Thought at gpbnews.org and subscribe to the OST podcast so you won't miss conversations like this. I'm Virginia Prescott on Facebook at Virginia Prescott GPB. And this is On Second Thought. Was she afraid of me? Was I the first?